We'd like to thank our friends at PwC for their support, partnership, and collaboration in making Retail Gets Real. Learn more about how PwC helps retailers at pwc.com.
And this idea of really thinking of yourself as, in a sense, a power player, an animal that is thriving on learning, I think is really important. And to get to that, the thing that entrepreneurs have that I love is relentless curiosity. Like, nobody learns a thing unless they're curious.
I'm Bill Thorne from the National Retail Federation, and this is Retail Gets Real, where we talk with retail's most fascinating leaders about the industry that impacts everyone, everywhere, every day. For today's episode, I'm handing the microphone over to my colleague and my friend, Jen Overstreet. Take it away, Jen.
Thank you, Bill. I'm here with Jeffrey Rayport, who's faculty at the Harvard Business School in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit of the school. We're chatting with Jeffrey here at NRF Next, the National Retail Federation's brand new event designed specifically to provide tactical tips for digital retail practitioners. And this is a great backdrop to talk with Jeffrey about the retail landscape today and how retailers can keep their teams up to date in a quickly changing world. Joining me today is Jill Dvorak, Senior Director of Digital Retail here at NRF. Jill, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. This is an exciting morning to be here.
And thank you, Jeffrey. Welcome to Retail Gets Real.
Thank you, Jen. It's great to be here.
So, Jeffrey, we've invited you here today because we think you have a very interesting perspective on retail from where you sit at the Harvard Business School and some of your past experiences. I was hoping you could open this up a little bit by talking about the current landscape of retail. Things are changing so fast. What is going on out there?
Well, I think that you could argue that if legacy or established retail is kind of under threat from three different avenues. And so in a sense, three categories of attackers to worry about. It's really clear that there's something interesting going on with new retail brand DNA around digitally native vertical brands. So specialist brands that are born mobile, they're born digital, they're born social. And I think most importantly, they're born on the demand side, on the customer side of the equation. You think about traditionally how we built brands, whether it's in CPG or in beauty or even fashion apparel. You figure out you've got an interesting product. You buy some mode of production. You create mass quantities of it and then use mass marketing or mass distribution through retail to reach an audience, a bunch of customers. And these new brands, digitally native brands, in effect are invented first by discovering a demand pattern among consumers and then reverse engineering everything else, the supply chain, the actual product. In a sense, they are lead generation operations, scanning the market for demand signals, as ad tech people like to call them, and then building, in a sense, brand and then ultimately retail businesses behind them. And it's, of course, fascinating because most of these started as direct-to-consumer brands, but many of them, Werby's, Bonobos, scores of others, are now integrating into brick-and-mortar retail just when conventional wisdom was saying brick-and-mortar retail was dead. So that idea of vertical specialists that takes the idea of the concept of a category killer from 20, 30 years ago takes it to a whole new level of specialization. And these brands are forging just extraordinarily powerful and loyal relationships with consumers. Then I think at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the companies that are positioning as platforms that are much more about efficiency and distribution often of third-party offers. So clearly, paradigmatic example here in the U.S. is Amazon Marketplace, but Shopify is another example, that big commerce, what used to be GSI Commerce and Demandware, all companies that were essentially creating rentable platforms for multiple retail tenants to run their online operations. So that idea of a retail operation as a platform, where platform is in a sense metaphorical, it has specific terms in the tech and software world, but all of these are, in effect, brand platforms to support omni-channel or multi-channel approaches to consumers. The platform play in the tech world, I think, is a little sobering because it involves not just the folks who are explicitly positioned against retail, Amazon, Shopify, but there are scaled platforms in a pure tech sense that, in a sense, are implicit or emerging competitors, third category of attacker, which is the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, who are increasingly integrating into e-commerce activity, not physical retail yet, but e-commerce activity, whether it's buy buttons on Instagram or the retail partnerships that Google has forged with, among others, Walmart and Costco. These are big forays into commerce from folks who have massively scaled platforms in the pure tech sense, But importantly, like retailers, they interact directly with consumers. But unlike any retailer in the world, including Amazon, they interact with more than a billion consumers a day in the cases of Google and Facebook. And so if what we're talking about is that the future of retail, to some extent, as big theme for us here at NRF Next in Vegas, is around data, then those guys win on data. So I think we've got sort of the vertical specialists, the DNVBs. We've got the explicit retail platforms. And then you've got the emergent or implicit retail platforms, which may be scariest of all.
Where does the old legacy retailer fit into all that? Where does Macy's fit? You know, the people that have been around for a long time that are now trying to reposition themselves, trying to, you know, make sure that they're meeting needs for consumers when their needs are changing so drastically.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think to take the bullish argument here, sort of the good news, not the bad news, or the cup half full, it's sort of a commonplace these days to talk about businesses that are two things, customer-centric and focused on customer experience. And the idea that we're an experience economy and that the most successful brands in the world are arguably experience platforms of some kind or another, Netflix, Red Bull, whatever you want to cite, in retail, outside of retail. So the idea that legacy retail operators own a bunch of platform in this day and age in 2019. It's not just brick and mortar, even if it's Macy's, it's huge online operations as well. So this idea that they own a platform for distinctive consumer experiences, I think is very profound. And it is a description of a kind of advantage that, for example, Google and Facebook do not have, and Amazon barely has with the acquisition of Whole Foods, 465 stores, and a couple Amazon Goes, does not give them the kind of retail presence that some of the major retail brands in this country have. The question is, of course, that begs the question, what do you do with it? But I do buy that wonderful phrase from Neil Blumenthal, one of the founders of Warby Parker, who said that retail isn't dead. Mediocre retail is dead. Yeah. I think the second thing, you know, on the very positive side, is that I increasingly believe that the world of consumer-facing brands, both the product brands that sell through retail and retail, is essentially divided between those who have direct access to consumers and collect data from those interactions and relationships and those that don't. And I think it's one of the great ironies of our modern world that, you know, what our students at Harvard Business School consider the academy company for consumer marketing, which is Procter & Gamble. Procter has an existential problem. They are, you know, 50 years of excellence in consumer marketing, and yet who would start a business today around excellence in consumer marketing when you were walled off from the very data that you could collect from the end users of your product? That is like a massive structural problem. And there are whole swaths of companies in our economy who are competing as consumer marketers who don't have access to what data science people refer to as first-party data, directly interacted, directly observed data with consumers. The thing for me that I think is most profound about the world of NRF and retailers is this is an industry that sort of by its birthright, for structural reasons, is awash in first-party data. So you could argue that, you know, people say data is the new oil. I think that's not quite right. Not all data is created equal, and there's a lot of data out there that's worthless.
Dirty data.
Dirty oil. Unprocessed data sitting in warehouses. So there are lots of ways of having unvaluable, sort of data, as in the exhaust of economic activity. But I don't think anyone would argue that in an economy where it is more and more competitive to get a consumer's attention, her time, and her purchasing power, there is no question that, you know, if all data is not created equal, customer data is more valuable than other kinds of data. And among customer data, not all data is created equal. And third-party syndicated data that's aggregated and historical is clearly, in a digital age, much less strategically valuable as an asset than first-party data collected in real time, as long as you have the analytics and, in a sense, the intelligence, the instincts as an organization to act on it. So the notion of an industry, and this is the very definition of retail, that specializes by running platforms, whether they're brick and mortar, their websites, their mobile apps, all of them, in a sense, have the opportunity to harvest some of the world's best data sets from a first-party customer data perspective. And that creates a huge structural advantage for retail vis-a-vis, say, the product companies that supply the merchandise, if they can develop the sophistication to both recognize the value of the data, put the data in a useful place, query the data with effective analytics, and then act on them which is clearly not a small task, but it's a lot harder if you don't have access to the data to begin with.
So data is definitely one of the themes for NRF Next, our digital deep dive. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, with this new landscape, what retailers should be learning about? What should be their priorities? And how did those insights shape what we're doing here today at NRF Next?
Well, the themes of the conference are three, and we've, in a sense, been implicitly and explicitly talking about all three of them. And the first one is data and analytics. And so clearly, this is a bunch of digital leaders within NRF who've gotten together in a group of about 300, essentially to have a three-day conversation about the opportunities represented by this and how to grapple with both the challenges, GDPR among them, California legislation, regulation. But we hope a great deal of upside. And I think for anyone who might be confused about why do a bunch of retailers get together and talk about data and analytics, I tend to think that, you know, the only way that we can do the things people want care about, yeah, that they want to see happen. People want to be treated in a humane way. People want to be treated in an individual way. People, yep, appreciate personalized offers. There's a lot of now research evidence indicating that personalization provides a 20-30% retail lift if well executed. In a sense, in an old-fashioned world, sitting on a little main street, there were nine people who came into the corner drugstore. Yep. Yeah, you could get to know everyone. And in a sense, your data management platform resided inside the head of, yeah, of
your sales associate.
The sales, yeah, sales associate, yeah, the guy behind the cashier, the phosphates counter, and the old 19th century Norman Rockwell construct. The problem is now to show that kind of humanity and personalization and care on an individual or segment of one basis, you can't do it at scale without data. And so I have a friend at Omnicom Group who had the interesting observation essentially to say that people just don't understand data. Data is insights with crappy branding. It's it's not, you know, it sounds cold and it sounds clinical, yeah, and it sounds like the imposition of science on the art of retail or the art of marketing. The reality is it's the most humane thing in the world. It's the only way that we get to know one another at scale and can serve people in individualized ways at scale. And then part and parcel of that second, yeah, theme is digital marketing. And clearly, this is a bunch of digital people. So, of course, exactly, we're talking about digital channels and e-commerce platforms. The third is one we were just talking about, which is customer experience. And that, I would argue, goes well beyond the digital conversation because we're essentially looking at digital as a way to knit together all of the touch points, some of them analog, some of them digital, yeah, to put together essentially seamless experiences across maybe a dozen touch points to, excellent, create the experiences that consumers seek, find compelling, and, of course, drive commercial activity. So it's a cool opportunity, in a sense, to take these three issues, which have been identified by this community at NFR Next, to do the collective deep dive into them to understand, like, where are our opportunities to move our own businesses and the industry forward?
Yeah. I mean, this group for, you know, the better part of a year has been saying these are our biggest challenges. We cannot solve them without the help of the community. So what's been really interesting is seeing, you know, there's kind of these typical retailer silos. You're, you know, maybe competing against each other in your head. But when you kind of step back and you look at all of your partners and competitors, everyone's facing the same issue. And what's been amazing is to see some partnerships pop up where, you know, one retailer has, you know, more stores and another retailer needs to be in stores. You know, when you look at these past competitors now becoming partners, going direct to consumer through someone's stores, you know, Target and Casper. Well, Target sells their own mattresses, right? But Casper went into those stores because they needed a direct-to-consumer place where people could try it, touch it, buy it. And Casper was online. So, you know, what used to be competitors, now they're joining together. And that's a lot of this conference, is bringing people together to look at new ways. You know, maybe it's a partnership, but maybe it's just a new way of thinking, of applying these data, these consumer insights to your business, you know, and knitting it all together to the point of, you know, the buzzwords change every year, you know, whether it's omnichannel or, you know, whatever it is. At the end of the day, it's about attribution. And how do you know where to invest smartly and to get the ROI that you need to fuel your business and that your board or, you know, the public needs for you to continually, you know, prove yourself on Wall Street?
Yes. And it is interesting, as long as I've known NRF, and especially the digital community within NRF, the ability to engage in very generous sharing of, yeah, best practices, of insights, of, yeah, pain points is really kind of remarkable.
Yeah. It's a special place. And coming from the retail side over now to be an NRF employee, that's one of the, I'd say one of the tenants that really started this event and created this event. So we came up with the themes through that community. We have come up with, obviously, many of the speakers on stage telling their case studies, telling their deep dives, but then figuring out how to solve them. And those are those deep dives. It's not just talking about problems, because we could be here for more than 3 days, but then how did you actually solve them? How did your team roll up their sleeves and fix it? So it's presenting challenges to make everybody understand what there is, but then going deeper to figure out how to solve.
And I think it's fair to say that now that Amazon is just over 50% of US e-commerce, that we are all non-competitive. We are competing with one company. And maybe as Google and Facebook move into commerce in some fashion, or at least into payments, we will conclude that we're competing with the three of them plus Apple. But it's internecine aspects are really not part of the dynamic, which is incredibly interesting and refreshing.
Yeah,
it's interesting. And it's almost like an expansion of the definition of retail in some ways. It's all these partnerships forming with, you know, sort of non-traditional partnerships that you wouldn't expect. I just love that about retail. Jeffrey, a couple more questions. We're getting a little close on time, but I wanted to ask you, you have some experience with professional education, you know, being with Harvard Business School, you teach a whole lot of smart people. When you were talking about the direct-to-consumer brands, the first thing I think about, and I think it's just because we produce this show, is just really smart people behind those brands. You know, Neil Blumenthal and, you know, some of the folks we've talked to on the show, KiwiCo and Rothy's, and they're just like Kuyana. I mean, we've had some really amazing entrepreneurs. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, who are these retail rock stars and how do we, you know, how do our attendees here at NRF Next, how do they become the next retail rock star?
That's a great question. I think if we really had the answer to it, we'd start a brand new business school right next to Harvard Business School and it'd be 10 times better and cooler.
Business idea, I gotta go.
But I think maybe just one comment about sort of what we do there. You know, the whole school is geared around case-based teaching. And so this is not a crowd pleaser for everyone, and it's not even a crowd pleaser for all faculty. But the fact is the school is completely dedicated to this idea that we get together in large groups, we sit in amphitheaters, everyone has a name tag in front of them, and the faculty are not sources of answers. They're sources of questions. And the questions are about cases which frame managerial situations, some of them good, some of them bad, some of the problems that need to be solved, decisions that need to be made. And I as somebody who's been in and out of an educational institution as a faculty member for now many years, I just, the one phrase that I absolutely can't stand, it's sort of a phrase like medical marijuana, is lifelong learning. It's just like, oh my God, it's such a cliche. And it sounds like extension school classes and people playing closed circuit videos back in the days when there was such a thing as video. It just, it's like deadly to even talk about it. So when I say goodbye to my students every year, I say, look, you know, forget the lifelong learning thing, but you do need to do it. But what you need to conceive of yourselves as, you have to be learning animals. Think of yourself as one of your primary purposes as a sentient creature on earth is not to stop learning when you leave here, but to be learning all the time. And this idea of really thinking of yourself as, in a sense, a power player, an animal that is thriving on learning, I think is really important. And to get to that, the thing that entrepreneurs have that I love is relentless curiosity. Yep. Like nobody learns a thing unless they're curious. And 100%. You know, and great companies, I mean, Swatch among them, was famous for having been built around a culture that nurtured in every human who worked there a sense of childlike curiosity, which Nick Hayek, who created the company and essentially collectively invented this thing called a Swatch. They completely reinvented a category and the way we related to the category and how many watches anyone would own.
Became fashion. It was fashion.
Absolutely.
And function.
And fueled by a technology miracle associated with automated manufacturing, the highest labor cost market in the world. So this idea of childlike curiosity, I think, is like a wonderful way to understand what does it mean for me to have a learning agenda? How do I fuel it? And of course, the only difference between childlike curiosity and adult version of that is that, yes, discipline, focus, directed childlike curiosity clearly counts. But I think that's where we all need to be. And in that sense, I think the, if you will, non-traditional educational environments like HBS really do advantage people. It's the opposite. It could not be more extremely opposite from the concept of rote learning or, you know, the Heidelberg University model of some wise, usually man standing in front of the room droning on in a mansplaining hour. This is all about orchestrated learning, collective learning that comes out of questioning, querying, being curious.
And I love that it's, you know, it's the case studies, but you wind up learning from your peers. When you look at a lot of these startups or digitally native brands, you know, a lot of times the founder themselves, obviously, is probably younger, has this curiosity, but they wind up listening to a lot of the peers around them to influence the business in a much more untraditional way than, you know, well, I'm the CEO and this kind of hierarchical. So I think a lot of that has come out of respecting other people's opinions, respecting whether they're, you know, tangential to you, whether they're horizontal, you know, vertical. And then a lot of the new org structures, I think, have come out of this type of learning where, you know, we have responsibilities, we have job roles, we have functions, but there really doesn't need to be some kind of a hierarchy here as long as there's somebody really making a decision. And so I think there's a lot that can come out of that and apply to whether it's retail, whether it's a specific department that, you know, a lot of companies should probably take note of and sit in on one of your classes and audit it.
It's a great point. They're always welcome to come to visit a class. I'm sure there's any magic there. But your broader point, I think, is a really important one, which is, you know, nobody in business has not heard now of design thinking. Design thinking starts with something called customer discovery, or sometimes called customer empathy.
Exactly.
That is all about querying and listening. It's about humility. It's about understanding that we're going to reverse engineer from what the customer wants.
We don't know
what's
right. You tell us.
We're not. Absolutely. Yeah. And so those as a model of what it takes to, in a sense, do this massive transformation that retail is going through, which I think, coming back to where we began with the digitally native brands, I mean, you imagine one set of brands, which are the received brands from 50 years ago that were built around somebody having a better mousetrap, to now a bunch of brands that are built around the fact that I've got a relationship with some number, addressable number of customers who have a common need. And I've discovered the need, and now I'm going to reverse engineer a company, an offer, a product, channels, the whole thing.
Yep, and disrupt them along with it. They disrupt those channels. Yeah.
There's no way you do something that is customer-centric in that way without, Jill, doing what you're talking about, which is going to start by questioning and be willing to listen. And so I think it's no coincidence that design thinking, which is very much demand-driven business creation, has become such an influential part of the way modern companies do business.
I like that. Well, Jeffrey, I'm so sorry. I want to go on talking about this, but we are coming to the end of our time, and I think that's a good place to stop. We are almost out of time, but we have one more segment before we let you go, and that is called Rapid Fire.
One of our favorite segments on Retail Gets Real is Rapid Fire, thanks to our sponsor, PwC.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Like three things. I wanted to be an architect, a filmmaker, and a teacher. And I got one out of three.
You got one out of three. That's great. I love it. Of course, not just one. You hit three. Okay. What is your proudest accomplishment to date?
That is a tough one. I'd say, you know, it's somewhat consistent with what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's not a singular one, but proudest accomplishment is what I do in a classroom. I mean, I think I find teaching deeply purposeful and meaningful, and it's like a wonderful way to allocate time and effort towards incredibly inspiring goals and outcomes.
People love that.
So you mentioned lifelong learning, but what is your most hated buzzword?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure this qualifies as a buzzword, but why does everyone in America, whenever you say thank you, they say no problem? Why does that happen when there actually is not a problem? It's one of those crazy things.
When you're at the Four Seasons Resort, they say, it's my pleasure.
That's right.
That's lovely.
Right? So try that. Test that out this week.
All right, Jill, you're up.
Well, okay. The best place you have ever traveled.
This is not super romantic, but I guess I think it is. My favorite city in the world, because that's most of the travel I've done has been travel, is Rome.
Oh,
I love that city. I don't think there's any city I've ever been in where I feel every single time. I felt this when I was first there as a six-year-old to being back there 6 months ago, that it's like for all of Rome's big city issues and trash collection, all the rest of it that the Italians can't quite seem to get in order, it is the only city in the world where I feel like somebody cast a magic spell on it. And that happened like 1,000 years ago, and it's still enchanted. So I adore that city.
And they might not have mastered trash, but they've mastered wine and food.
Wine and food.
Those are very important.
La Dolce Vita is very real there, as opposed to a mere aspiration for us North Americans.
I love it. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for being here. This was a lot of fun. Thank you, Jen, for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
It's been a blast.
This was fun.
And it's going to be so fun to see how NRF Next turns out. I think it's such a cool effort that we're working on, and Jill's been really instrumental, and Jeffrey, you as well, in just building this program. It's such a cool thing to know that we're trying so hard to give people something actual, tactical, filling their notebooks with stuff where they can actually make some progress when they get back to the office. So I think it's going to be great. Thank you all for listening to another episode of Retail Gets Real. You can find more information about today's discussion on our website, retailgetsreal.com. And please send your feedback and episode ideas to podcast@nrf.com. Thanks a lot for listening. See you next time.